but obvious in Urethiru. "It is natural," the Stormfather said. "A cycle. I will go higher and higher until I am taller than the tower. Then the next few storms will be lower. The High Storm did this before the tower existed." There seemed to be a timidity to the words, uncharacteristic of the Stormfather. Perhaps Dalinar had rattled him. Soon he saw the tower approaching.
"You can see it," the Stormfather said. "The details."
"Yes," Dalinar said.
"Look quickly. We will pass rapidly."
Dalinar steered himself as a gust of wind fixating upon Urethiru. Nothing seemed overtly wrong with it. There wasn't anyone up on the cloudwalk level, but with the storms growing higher, that wouldn't be advisable anyway.
"Can we go inside?" Dalinar asked as they approached.
"You may," the Stormfather said. "I cannot go inside, just as I cannot infuse spheres indoors. When a piece splits off, it is no longer me. You will need to quickly rejoin or the vision will end."
Dalinar picked the lowest accessible balcony in the tower's east jutting lobes, up on the fourth tier, and lowered himself until he was right on target. As the storm passed, he soared in through the open balcony into the quiet hallway beyond. It was over too swiftly, a rush through a dark hallway until he found the southern diagonal corridor, where he tried to reach the ground floor, but Dalinar was suddenly pulled out another balcony without having seen any signs of life. The storm wall passed by to crest the mountains and continue onward toward Aesir and his body.
"No,"
Dalinar said.
"We need to look again. You must continue forward. Momentum, Dalinar."
"Momentum kept me doing terrible things, Stormfather. Momentum alone is not a virtue."
"We cannot do what you ask."
"Stop making excuses and try for once,"
Dalinar said, provoking lightning around him. He resisted the push to continue at the front end, and, though it caused the Stormfather to groan with fits of thunder, Dalinar moved into the inner portions of the storm, the black chaos behind the storm wall. He was wind blowing against wind, a man swimming against a tide, but he pushed all the way back to Urethiru. The Stormfather grumbled, but Dalinar didn't sense pain from the spren, just surprise, as if the Stormfather were genuinely curious about what Dalinar had managed to do. It was difficult to stay in place, but he hovered outside the first tier, searching for anything alarming. The fury of the wind tugged at him. The Stormfather rumbled and lightning flashed. There, Dalinar felt something. A faint connection, like when he learned someone's language. His surge binding, his powers, drew him through the wind around the outside base of the tower until he found something remarkable. A single figure, almost invisible in the darkness, clinging to the outside of the tower on the eighth level. Kaladin Stormblessed. Dalinar could not fathom what had brought the Windrunner to expose himself like this in a storm, but here he was, holding on tightly to a ledge. His clothing was ragged, and he was wounded, bleeding from numerous cuts.
"Blood of my fathers," Dalinar whispered.
"Stormfather, do you see him?"
"I feel him," the Stormfather said, "through you. He seems to be waiting for the center of the storm where his spheres and stormlight will renew."
Dalinar drew close to the young man, who had buried his head into his shoulder for protection. He was soaked through, a piece of his shirt slapping against the stone over and over.
"Kaladin!"
Dalinar shouted.
"Kaladin! What has happened?"
The young man didn't move. Dalinar calmed himself, resisting the furious winds, and drew power from the soul of the storm.
"Kaladin!" he said.
Kaladin shifted, turning his head. His skin had gone pale, his hair matted and whipped into rain-drenched knots. Storms, he looked like a dead man.
"What has happened?"
Dalinar demanded as the storm.
"Singer invasion," Kaladin whispered into the wind. "Navani captured. The tower on lockdown. Other Radiants are all unconscious."
"I will find help."
"Radiant powers don't work. except mine. Maybe those of a bondsmith. I'm fighting. I'm trying.
Life before death.
Life,
Kaladin whispered.
Life before.
The man's eyes fluttered closed. He sagged, going limp, and dropped off the wall, unconscious.
No!
Dalinar gathered the winds, and with a surge of strength used them to hurl Kaladin up and over the ledge of the balcony onto the 8th floor of the tower. That strained his abilities, and at last the tide grabbed Dalinar and forced him toward the front of the storm. As it happened, he was ejected from the vision and found himself in Emuel, sitting in his chair. An honor guard of soldiers had arrived, forming a circle around him so people couldn't gawk. Though it had been a long time since Dalinar had been taken involuntarily in a vision, he appreciated the gesture. He shook himself, rising to stand. Nearby, Martra held up her notebook.
I wrote down everything you said and did, like Brightness Devana used to. Did I do it right?
Thank you, Dalinar said, scanning what she'd written. It seemed he had spoken out loud, like when in one of the old visions. Only Martra hadn't heard the parts where he'd spoken as the storm. One of the guards coughed, and Dalinar noticed one of the others gawking at him. The youth turned away immediately, blushing. Because I was reading, Dalinar thought, handing back the notebook. He looked at the sky, expecting to see storm clouds, though here the high storm would still be hours away from this region. Stormfather, he thought, the tower was invaded. Our worst fears are confirmed. The enemy controls Urethiru. Storms that felt painful to acknowledge. First Alethkar, then the tower, and Navani captured? Now he knew why the enemy had thrown away Taravangian, maybe even the entire army here in Emuel. They'd been sacrificed to keep Dalinar occupied.
Go to Teshuv, Dalinar said to Martra. Have her gather the monarchs and my high lords. I need to call an emergency meeting. Cancel everything else I was to do today.
The young woman yelped, perhaps at being given such an important task. She ran on his orders immediately. The soldiers parted at Dalinar's request, and he looked toward the sky again.
Stormfather, did you hear me?
You have hurt me, Dalinar. This is the second time you have done so. You push against our bond, forcing me to do things that are not right.
I push you to stretch, Dalinar said. That is always painful. Did you hear what Stormblast told me?
Yes, he said, but he is wrong. Your powers will not work at Urethiru. It seems they have turned the tower's protections against us. If that is true, you would need to be orders of magnitude stronger, more experienced than you are, to open a perpendicularity there. You'd have to be strong enough to overwhelm the sibling.
I need to say more oaths, Dalinar said. I need to better understand what I can do. My training goes too slowly. We need to find a way to speed it up.
I cannot help you. Honor is dead. He was the only one who knew what you could do in full. He was the only one that could have trained you.
Dalinar growled in frustration. He began to pace the unworked stone in front of his war camp house.
Kaladin, Shallan, Yasna, Lift, all of them picked up on their powers naturally, Dalinar said. But here I am, many months after our bonding, and I have barely progressed.
You are something different from them, the Stormfather replied. Something greater, more dangerous, but also more complicated. There has never been another like you.
Distant thunder, drawing closer.
Except, the Stormfather said.
Dalinar looked up as a thought struck him, likely the same one that had occurred to the Stormfather. There was another bondsmith. A short time later, an out-of-breath Dalinar arrived at a small building in the far northern part of the camp. People raced about, preparing for the imminent storm, but he ignored them. Instead, he burst into the small building, surprising a woman tending to a hulking man seated on the floor, bent forward, muttering to himself. The woman leaped to her feet, reaching for the sword she wore at her side. She was of a difficult race to distinguish, maybe Azish, with that dark skin tone, but her eyes were wrong, like a Shin person. These two were beings trapped outside of time, creatures almost as ancient as Roshar, the heralds Shalash and Telan Elot. Dalinar ignored the woman's threatening pose and strode forward, seizing her by the shoulders.
There were 10 of you, 10 heralds. All were members of an order of Knights Radiant.
No, Shalash said. We were before the Radiants. They were modeled upon us, but we were not in their ranks. Except for Nail.
But there was one of you who was a bondsmith, Dalinar said. Ishi, Herald of Luck, Herald of Mysteries, Binder of Gods.
Creator of the Oath Pact, Shalash said, forcing herself out of Dalinar's grip. Yes, yes, we all have names like that. Useless names. You should stop talking about us, stop worshipping us, stop painting us.
He's still alive, Dalinar said. He was unchained by the oaths. He would understand what I can learn to do.
I'm sure, Shalash said. If any, except me, are still sane, it would be him.
He's near here, Dalinar said, in awe. In Tukar, not more than a short flight southeast of this very town.
Isn't there an army in the way? Shalash said. Isn't pushing the enemy back, crushing them into Ishar's army, our main goal right now?
That's what Yasna and our army are doing, Dalinar said. But I have another task. I need to find a way to speak to the god priest, then convince him to help me rescue Urethiru.
72. Outmatched. Intent matters. Intent is king. You cannot do what I attempt by accident. You must mean it. This seems a much greater law than we've ever before understood. From Rhythm of War, end notes. Navani sat quietly in her cell of a library room, waiting. Hours passed. She requested food and was given it, but neither the guard nor the deepest one watching her answered when she asked questions. So she waited, too nervous to study, too sick to her stomach to dare try speaking to the sibling. After all her assurances and promises, Navani had proven untrustworthy after all. Raboniel finally arrived, wearing a simple outfit of trousers, a blouse, and a Thalen vest. She'd previously said she found their designs fascinating. She'd chosen traditionally male clothing, but likely didn't mind the distinction. The Lady of Wishes observed Navani from the doorway, then shooed the guards away. Navani gritted her teeth, then stood up and bowed. She'd been hurt, outmatched, and defeated, but she couldn't let anger and humiliation rule. She needed information.
You didn't persist in trying to contact me, Raboniel said. I assume you realized what had happened.
How long were you listening in on my conversations with the sibling, Ancient One? Navani said.
Always, Raboniel said. When I could not be listening in, I had another fused doing it.
Navani closed her eyes.
I gave them the secret to the third node. I pried it out of the sibling, walking directly into the enemy's plan. You shouldn't be too hard on yourself, Raboniel said. The sibling is truly to blame. They always have been so innocent and unaware of their own naiveness. When I touched the pillar, I knew the sibling was awake, but pretending to be dead. So I let the ruse continue, and I listened. I couldn't know that decision would bear fruit, but that is why you nurture 9 seeds and watch for the one that begins growing.
The sibling told me, Navani said.
They said we couldn't outthink you. Yes, I heard that, Raboniel said. It made me worry that you'd spotted my surveillance. It seemed too obvious a line said to distract me. How? Navani asked, opening her eyes. How did you do it, Ancient One? Surely the sibling would have known if their communication could be compromised. Raboniel hummed a rhythm, then walked over and tapped Navani's stacks of notes. Study. Find us answers about light, Navani. Stop trying to fight me. Help me end this war instead. That was always your purpose here. Navani felt nausea stirring her insides. She'd thrown up once already from the sick feeling of what she'd done, what she'd cost the sibling. She forced it down this time, and as Raboniel left, she managed to ask one more question. Kaladin, she said. The Windrunner. Did you kill him, Ancient One? I didn't, she said, though I did land a fine cut on him. You have likely realized that he succeeded in destroying the node, as the shield is still up. However, when the Windrunner was spotted fleeing the tower a good half hour after, his wound hadn't healed, so I think the sibling's transformation is almost complete. This makes your Windrunner's powers quite unreliable. I find it unlikely he survived after running out into the storm. Into the storm? Navani asked. Yes. A pity. Perhaps the sibling can tell you if he is dead or not. If so, I should very much like to study his corpse. Raboniel left. Navani pushed through her sickness to write, then burn, a prayer of protection for Kaladin. It was all she could do. Then she rested her head on the table to think about the profound scope of her failure.
The end of part 3. Interludes. Zeth, Chiri Chiri, Taravangian.
Shallan's sketchbook. Highspren. Highspren are enigmatic beings in the best of circumstances. In Shadesmar, their forms are as solid as any of the other Spren, although they appear as human-shaped holes in reality, spaces that look out onto unfamiliar starry skies. When they move, the stars do not move with them. Watching these beings walk is like looking through a moving window onto an alternate reality. Distinguishing individual Highspren is incredibly difficult, unless they happen to have a distinct silhouette. However, Highspren seem to have no difficulty in identifying one another. In the physical realm, they appear as a tear, or hole, hanging in the air.
Interlude 7. Zeth. Zeth, son Honor, tried to slouch. Dalinar said that slouching a little would help him imitate an ordinary soldier on a boring guard duty. Dalinar said Zeth prowled when he walked and was too intense when standing at watch, like a fire burning high when it should be smoldering. How did one stop being intense? Zeth tried to understand this as he forced himself to lean against a tree, folding his arms as Dalinar had suggested. In front of him, the Blackthorn played with his grand-nephew, the child of Elkar. Zeth carefully checked the perimeter of the small clearing, watching for shadows, or for people suspiciously lingering in the nearby camp, visible through the trees. He saw nothing which troubled him, but he tried to relax anyway. The cloudy sky and muggy weather today were reminiscent of the coast of Shinovar, where Zeth's father had worked as a shepherd in his youth. With this thick grass, Zeth could almost imagine he was home, near the beautiful white cliffs, listening to lambs bleat as he carried water. He heard his father's gentle words,
The best and truest duty of a person is to add to the world, to create and not destroy. But no, Zeth was not home. He was standing on profane stone in a forest clearing outside a small town in Emul. Dalinar knelt down, showing Gavinor, a child not yet 5, how to hold his practice sword. It had been a few minutes, so Zeth left the tree and made a circuit of the clearing, inspecting a few suspicious bundles of vines.
"Do you see anything dangerous, Sword Nimi?" he asked softly.
"Nope," the sword said. "I think you should draw me. I can see better when I'm drawn."
"When you are drawn, Sword Nimi, you attempt to drain my life."
"Nonsense. I like you. I wouldn't try to kill you."
The weapon projected its pleasant voice into Zeth's mind. Dalinar didn't like the sensation, so the sword now spoke only to Zeth.
"I see nothing dangerous," Zeth said, returning to his place beside the tree, then tried to at least appear relaxed.
It was difficult, requiring vigilance and dedication, but he did not want to be chastised by Dalinar again.
"That's good, right? Nothing dangerous?"
"No, Sword Nimi," Zeth said. "It is not good. It is concerning. Dalinar has so many enemies. They will be sending assassins, spies. If I do not see them, perhaps I am too lax or unskilled."
"Or maybe they aren't here to find," the sword said. "Vasher was always paranoid, too, and he could sense if people were near. I told him to stop worrying so much. Like you. Worry, worry, worry."
"I have been given a duty," Zeth said. "I will do it well."
Dalinar laughed as the young boy held his toy sword high and proclaimed himself a windrunner. The child had been through a horrifying experience back in Kolinar, and he was quiet much of the time. Haunted. He'd been tortured by Voidspren, manipulated by the Unmade, neglected by his mother. Though Zeth's sufferings had been different, he couldn't help but feel a kinship with the child. Dalinar clearly enjoyed seeing the child become more expressive and enthusiastic as they played. Zeth was reminded again of his own childhood spent playing with the sheep. A simple time, before his family had been given to the Honor Blades, before his gentle father had been taught to kill, to subtract. His father was still alive in Shinovar, bearer of a different sword, a different burden. Zeth's entire family was there, his sister, his mother. It had been long since he'd considered them. He let himself do so now because he'd decided he wasn't truthless. Before, he hadn't wanted to sully their images with his mind. Time to make another round of the clearing. The child's laughter grew louder, but Zeth found it painful to hear. He winced as the boy jumped up on a rock, then leaped for his grand uncle to catch him. And Zeth... If Zeth moved too quickly, he could catch sight of his own frail soul, attached incorrectly to his body, trailing his motions like a glowing afterimage.
"Why do you hurt?" the sword asked.
"I am afraid for the child," Zeth whispered. "He begins to laugh happily. That will eventually be stolen from him again."
"I like to try to understand laughter," the sword said. "I think I can feel it. Happy? Ha! Ha! Vivenna always liked my jokes, even the bad ones."
"The boy's laughter frightens me," Zeth said, "because I am near, and I am not well."
He should not guard this child, but he could not bring himself to tell Dalinar for fear the Blackthorn would send him away. Zeth had found purpose here in following an ideal, in trusting Dalinar Kolin. He could not afford to have that ideal shaken. He could not. Except, Dalinar spoke uncertainly sometimes, concerned that he wasn't doing the right thing. Zeth wished he didn't hear Dalinar's weakness, his worries. The Blackthorn needed to be a moral rock, unshakable, always certain. Dalinar was better than most. He was confident, most of the time. Zeth had only ever met one man more confident than Dalinar in his own morality, Taravangian, the tyrant, the destroyer, the man who had followed Zeth here to this remote part of the world. Zeth was certain that, when he'd been visiting Taravangian with Dalinar the other day, the old man had seen through his illusory disguise. The man would not let go. Zeth could feel him. Feel him plotting. When Zeth returned to his tree, the air split, showing a blackness speckled faintly with stars beyond. Zeth immediately set down his sword by the trunk of the tree. "Watch," he said, "and shout for me if danger comes."
"Oh, all right," the sword said. "I can do that. Yes, I can. You might want to leave me drawn, though, you know, so that if someone bad comes along, I can really get him."
Zeth walked around the rear of the tree, following the rift in the air. It was as if someone had pried back the fabric of reality, like splitting skin to look at the flesh underneath. He knelt before the high spren. "You do well, my acolyte," the spren said, its tone formal. "You are vigilant and dedicated."
"I am," Zeth said.
"We need to discuss your crusade. You are a year into your current oath, and I am pleased and impressed with your dedication. You are among the most vigilant and worthy of men. I would have you earn your plate. You still wish to cleanse your homeland?" Zeth nodded. Behind, Dalinar laughed. He didn't seem to have noticed Zeth's momentary departure. "Tell me more of this proposed crusade," the Highspren said. It had not blessed Zeth with its name, though Zeth was its bonded radiant.
"Long ago, my people rejected my warnings," Zeth said. "They did not believe me when I said the enemy would soon return. They cast me out, deemed me truthless."
"I find inconsistencies to the stories you tell of those days, Zeth," the Highspren said. "I fear that your memory, like those of many mortals, is incomplete or corrupted by the passage of time. I will accompany you on your crusade to judge the truth."
"Thank you," Zeth said softly.
"You may need to fight and destroy those who have broken their own laws. Can you do this?"
"I would need to ask Dalinar. He is my ideal."
"If you progress as a skybreaker," the Highspren said, "you will need to become the law. To reach your ultimate potential, you must know the truth yourself, rather than relying on the crutch presented by the third ideal. Be aware of this."
"I will."
"Continue your duty for now, but remember the time will soon come when you must abandon it for something greater." Zeth stood as the spren made itself invisible again. It was always nearby, watching and judging his worthiness. He entered the clearing and found Dalinar chatting quietly with a woman in a messenger uniform. Immediately, Zeth came alert, seizing the sword and striding over to stand behind Dalinar, prepared to protect him.
"I hope it's all right that I didn't call for you," the sword said. "I could sense her, although I couldn't see her, and she seemed to be not evil, even if she didn't come over to pick me up. Isn't that rude? But rude people cannot be evil, right?"
Zeth watched the woman carefully. If someone wanted to kill Dalinar, they'd surely send an assassin who seemed innocent.
"I'm not sure about some of the things on this list," she was saying. "A pen and paper? For a man?"
"Taravangian has long since abandoned the pretense of being unable to read," Dalinar said.
"Then paper will let him plot against us."
"Perhaps," Dalinar said. "It could also simply be a mercy, giving him the companionship of words.
Fulfill that request. What else?
He wishes to be given fresh food more often, she said, and more light.
I asked for the light already, Dalinar said. Why hasn't the order been fulfilled?
Zeth watched keenly. Taravangian was making demands? They should give him nothing. He was dangerous, he.
Zeth froze as the little boy Gavinor stepped up to him.
He raised a wooden sword, hilt first, toward Zeth. The boy should fear him, yet instead he smiled and waggled the sword. Zeth took it, hesitant.
The stone is the oddest request, the messenger woman said. Why would he have need of a perfectly round, smooth stone? And why would he specify one with a vein of quartz?
Zeth's heart nearly stopped. A round stone with quartz inclusions?
An odd request indeed, Dalinar said, thoughtful. Ask him why he wants this before fulfilling the request.
A round stone with quartz inclusions. An oath stone. For years, Zeth had obeyed the law of the oath stone. The centuries-old tradition among his people dictated the way to treat someone who was truthless. An object, no longer a man. Something to own. Taravangian wanted an oath stone. Why? Why?
As the messenger trotted away, Dalinar asked if Zeth would like to join sword practice, but he could barely mumble an excuse. Zeth returned to his spot by the tree, clutching the little wooden sword. He had to know what Taravangian was planning. He had to stop the man before he killed Dalinar.
Interlude 8. Chiri Chiri. Chiri Chiri tried to hide in her grass. Unfortunately, she was growing too big. She wasn't like a regular Kremling, those that scuttled around, tiny and insignificant. She was something grander. She could think, she could grow, and she could fly. None of that helped as she tumbled out of the grass of the pot onto the desktop. She rolled over and clicked in annoyance, then looked toward Rissen, who sat making noises with another soft one. Chiri Chiri did not always understand the mouth noises of the soft ones. They did not click, and there was no rhythm to them, so the sounds were sometimes just noises. Sometimes they were not. There was a pattern to them that she was growing better at understanding, and there was a mood at times to their tones, almost like a rhythm. She crawled closer along the desk, trying to listen. It was difficult. Chiri Chiri did not like listening. She liked to do what felt right. Sleeping felt right. Eating felt right. Saying she was happy or hungry or sad felt right. Communication should be about moods, desires, needs. Not all these flapping, flapping, sloppy, wet noises. Like the ones Rissen made now, talking to the old soft one who was like a parent. Chiri Chiri crawled over the desk and into her box. It didn't smell as alive as the grass, but it was nice, stuffed with soft things and covered over with some vines. She clicked for it. Contentment. Contentment felt right.
I do not understand half of what you explain, Rissen, the old soft one said, as the two sat in chairs beside the table.
Chiri Chiri understood some of the words, and his hushed tone, yet tense. Confused, that was confusion, like when you are bitten on the tail by one you thought was happy.
You're saying these things, these sleepless, are all around us, moving among us, but they aren't human?
They are as far from human as a being can get, I should guess, Rissen said, sipping her tea. Chiri Chiri understood her better. Rissen wasn't confused, more thoughtful. She'd been that way ever since the event at the homeland.
This is not what I thought I was preparing you for, the old soft one said, with your training in negotiation.
Well, you always like to travel paths others thought too difficult, Rissin said. And you relish trading with people ignored by your competition. You saw opportunity in what others discarded. This is somewhat the same.
Pardon, Rissin, dear child, but this feels very different.
The two fell silent, but it wasn't the contented silence of having just eaten. Cheery Cheery turned to snuggle back into her blankets, but felt a vibration coming up through the ground. A kind of call, a kind of warning, one of the rhythms of Roshar. It reminded her of the carapace of the dead ones she had seen in the homeland, their hollow skull chitin, their gaping emptiness, so still and noiseless, a silence of having eaten all and having then been consumed. Cheery Cheery could not hide. The rhythm whispered that she could not do only easy things. Dark times were coming, the hollow skulls warned, and the vibrations of that place, encouraging, demanding, be better, you must be better. And so, Cheery Cheery climbed out of her box and crawled up onto the arm of Rissin's chair. Rissin scooped her up, assuming she wanted scratches at the part along her head where carapace met skin. And it did feel nice. Nice enough that Cheery Cheery forgot about hollow skulls and warning rhythms.
Why do I feel, the old soft one said, that you shouldn't have told me about any of this? The more people who know what you've done, Rissin, the more dangerous it will be for you.
I realize this, she said. But, Babsk, I had to tell someone. I need your wisdom. Now more than ever.
My wisdom does not extend to the dealings of gods, Rissin, he said. I am just an old man who thought himself clever until his self-indulgences nearly destroyed the life and career of his most promising apprentice.
Rissin sat up sharply, causing Cheery Cheery to start and nip at her fingers. Why did she stop scratching? Oh, emotions. Cheery Cheery could nearly feel them thrumming through Rissin, like rhythms. She was sad? Why sad? They had enough to eat. It was warm and safe. Was it about the hollowness? The danger?
Babsk, Rissin said. You still blame yourself for my foolishness? My follies were mine alone. Ah, but I knew of your brashness, he said. And it was my duty to check it.
He took her hands, so Cheery Cheery nipped at them a little, until Rissin glared at her. They didn't taste good, anyway. The two soft ones shared something. Almost like they could project emotions with a vibration or a buzz, instead of flapping their lips and squishing their two melty faces. Those really were odd. Why didn't all their skin flop off without carapace to hold it in? Why didn't they hurt themselves on everything they bumped? But yes, they shared thoughts. And finally the old one nodded, standing.
I will help you bear this, Rissin. Yes, I should not complain about my own deficiencies. You have come to me and show me great honor in doing so.
But you mustn't tell anyone, she said to him. Not even the queen. I'm sorry.
I understand, he said. I will ponder what you've told me, then see what advice, if any, I can have on this unique situation.
He took his hat and moved to leave, but hesitated and said a single word.
Dawn shards.
He imbued it with meaning somehow, disbelief and wonder. After he'd left, a few nips got Rissin to start scratching again, but she felt distracted, and soon Cheery Cheery was unable to enjoy the scratches, not with the hollow eyes speaking to her, warning her. To enjoy easy days, sometimes you had to first do difficult things. Rissin activated her chair,
which flew a few inches off the ground, though it didn't have any wings. Chiri Chiri jumped off onto the desk.
I need something to eat, Rissin said.
And Chiri Chiri concentrated on the sounds, not the tired cadence. Eat. Food.
Eat.
Chiri Chiri tried to get her mandibles to click the sounds, blowing through her throat and making her carapace vibrate. Rissin smiled.
I'm too tired. That almost sounded... Rissin,
Chiri Chiri said.
Eat. Food.
Yes, that seemed right. Those were good mouth noises. At least, Rissin dropped her cup of tea and made a shocked vibration. Perhaps doing it this way would be better, not just because of the hollow skulls, but because if the soft ones could be made to understand, it would be far easier to get scratches when they were required.
Interlude 9. The Sword. Taravangian awoke hurting. Lately, each morning was a bitter contest. Did it hurt more to move or to stay in bed? Moving meant more pain. Staying in bed meant more anguish. Eventually, he chose pain. After dressing himself with some difficulty, he rested at the edge of the bed, exhausted. He glanced at the notes scratched on the side of an open drawer. Should he hide that? He should. The words appeared jumbled to him today. He had to stare at them a long time to get them to make sense. Dumb. How dumb was he? Too dumb. He recognized the sensation, his thoughts moving as if through thick syrup. He stood. Was that light? Yes, sunlight. He shuffled into the main room of his prison. Sunlight through an open window. Strange, he hadn't left a window open. Windows were all boarded up, he thought. Someone broke one. Maybe a storm? No, he slowly realized that Dalinar must have ordered one opened. Kindly Dalinar. He liked that man. Taravangian made his way to the sunlight. Guards outside? Yes, they would watch. They knew he was a murderer. He smiled at them anyway, then opened the small bundle on the windowsill. A notebook, a pen, and some ink. Had he asked for that? He tried to remember. Storms, he wanted to sleep. But he couldn't sleep through another day. He'd done that too often. He returned to his room and sat, then realized he had forgotten what he'd intended to do. He retraced his steps, looked down at the pen and paper again, and only then remembered. He went back into his bedroom, unhooked the drawer with the instructions, slowly read them. Then again. He laboriously copied them into the notebook. They were a list of things he needed to say if he could meet Zeth alone. Several times the words, "Don't talk to Dalinar," were underlined. In his current state, Taravangian was uncertain about that. Why not talk to him? Smarter him was convinced they needed to do this themselves. Dalinar Kolin could not be entrusted with Taravangian's plans. For Dalinar Kolin would do what was right, not what was needed. Taravangian forced himself to get food. He had some in the other room, bread that had gone stale. He should have asked for better food. Only after chewing on it did he think to go look at the table right inside his door where they delivered his meals. Today was the day new food came. And there it was. Fresh bread, dried meat, no jam. He felt like a fool. Why not look for fresh food before forcing yourself to choke down the old stuff? It was difficult to live like this, making easy mistakes, forgetting what he was doing and why. At least he was alone. Before he'd gotten good staff, people had always been so angry at him when he was stupid. And since he got emotional when stupid, he often cried. Didn't they understand? He made their lives difficult, but he lived the difficulty. He wasn't trying to be a problem. People took their minds for granted. They thought themselves wonderful because of how they'd been born.
Traitor,
a voice called into the room. You have a visitor. Taravangian felt a spike of alarm, his fingers shaking as he closed and gripped the notebook.
A visitor? Zeth had come. Taravangian's planted seed bore fruit?
He breathed in and out, trying to sort through his thoughts. They were a jumble, and the shouting guard made him jump, then scramble toward the sound. He prepared himself for the sight of Zeth. That haunted stare, those dead eyes. Instead, at the window, Taravangian saw a young man with black hair peppered blonde, the Blackthorn's son, Renarin. Taravangian hesitated, though the guards waved for Taravangian to come speak to the youth. He hadn't prepared for this, Renarin, their quiet salvation. Why had he come? Taravangian hadn't prepared responses in his notebook for this meeting. Taravangian stepped up to the window, and the guards retreated to give them privacy. Here Taravangian waited, expecting Renarin to speak first. Yet the boy stood silent, keeping his distance from the window, as if he thought Taravangian would reach out and grab him. Taravangian's hands were cold. His stomach churned.
Something changed, Renarin finally said, looking away as he spoke.
He avoided meeting people's eyes.
Why? About you. Recently. Why?
I do not know, Bright Lord,
Taravangian said, though he felt sweat on his brow at the lie.
You've hurt my father, Renarin said. I believe he thought, up until recently, that he could change you. I don't know that I've seen him as morose as when he speaks of you.
I would...
Taravangian tried to think. Words. What words?
I would that he had changed me, Bright Lord. I would that I could have been changed.
I believe that is true, Renarin said. I see your future, Taravangian. It is dark. Not like anything I've seen before. Except there's a point of light flickering in the darkness. I worry what it will mean if that goes out.
I would worry, too.
I can be wrong,
Renarin said. He hesitated, then closed his eyes, as if carefully thinking through his next words.
You are in darkness, Taravangian, and my father thinks you are lost. I lived through his return, and it taught me that no man is ever so far lost that he cannot find his way back. You are not alone.
The young man opened his eyes, stepped forward, then lifted his hand and presented it toward Taravangian. The gesture felt awkward, as if Renarin wasn't quite sure what he was doing.
He wants me to take his hand.
Taravangian didn't. Seeing it made him want to break into tears, but he contained himself. Renarin withdrew his hand and nodded.
I'll let you know if I see something that could help you decide.
With that, the boy left, accompanied by one of the guards, the man who had yelled at Taravangian earlier. That left one other guard, a short, nondescript Alethi man who walked up to the window to eye Taravangian. Taravangian watched Renarin walking away, wishing he had the courage to call after the boy. Foolish emotions. Taravangian was not lost in darkness. He had chosen this path, and he knew precisely where he was going. Didn't he?
He is wrong, the guard said. We can't all return from the dark. There are some acts that, once committed, will always taint a man.
Taravangian frowned. That guard had a strange accent. He must have lived in Shinovar.
Why did you ask for an oath stone? The guard demanded. What is your purpose? Do you wish to tempt or trick me?
I don't even know you.
The man stared at him with unblinking eyes, eyes like one of the dead, and Taravangian finally understood what on any other day he would have seen immediately. The guard wore a different illusion today.
Zeth,
Taravangian whispered.
Why? Why do you seek an oathstone? I will not follow your orders again. I am becoming my own man.
Do you have the sword?
Taravangian asked. He reached out, foolish though it was, and tried to grab Zeth. The man stepped away in an easy motion, leaving Taravangian grasping at air.
The sword. Did you bring it?
I will not serve you, Zeth said.
Listen to me, Taravangian said. You have to... The sword...
Wait a moment.
He furiously began flipping through the notebook for the words he'd copied from the desk drawer.
The sword, he read, is something we didn't anticipate. It was nowhere in the diagram, but Odium fears it. Do you understand? He fears it. I think it might be able to harm him. We attack him with it.
I will not serve you, Zeth said. I will not be manipulated by you again. My stone was always only a stone. My father said...
Your father is dead, Zeth, Taravangian said. Listen to me, listen,
he read from the notebook.
Fortunately, I believe his ability to see us here is limited. Therefore, we may talk freely. I doubt you can harm Odium directly unless you are in one of his visions. You must get into one of those visions. Can you do this?
There were more notes in the book about how to manipulate Zeth. Taravangian read them, and the words made him hurt. Hadn't this man been through enough? He rejected those manipulations and looked up at Zeth.
Please,
Taravangian whispered.
Please help me.
Zeth didn't appear to have heard. He turned to go.
No.
Listen,
Taravangian said, going off script, ignoring the orders of his smarter self.
Give Dalinar the sword. Dalinar is taken to Odium's vision sometimes. It should travel with him. Do you understand? Odium thinks the sword is in Urethiru. He doesn't realize you're here. He can't see it because of Renarin.
Smarter Taravangian claimed he didn't want to work with Dalinar because it was too dangerous, or because Dalinar wouldn't believe. Those lies made dumb Taravangian want to pound his fists at his own face out of shame. But the truth was more shameful. Zeth did not care which Taravangian he was speaking to.
I don't understand your manipulations, the man said as he walked away. I should have realized I wouldn't be able to understand the way your mind works. All I can do is refuse.
He left, sending the other guard back to watch Taravangian, who stood gripping his little notebook, crying. Part 4. A Knowledge. Adolin, Shallan, Navani, Benly, Eshonai, Bridge 4.
Alethi Glyphs, page 2. The calligraphic phonemes. The hybrid phonemes, below, have gained popularity recently and incorporate shortcuts experienced calligraphers have used for decades. In 100 years, I suspect this set will supersede the others and be the basis for a more streamlined Alethi glyph system. Now, on to different things, finally. You know my tendency towards boredom, and I suspect your giving me this latest errand was less to collect information and more for your own amusement, to see if you could interest me in something other than smuggling artifacts, covertly collecting strange weapons, and drawing in those secret sketchbooks you've endlessly chided me about since you discovered them. For the record, I also enjoy learning rude phrases in other languages, thank you very much, I'm not entirely uncultured. I regret to inform you that your clever scheme to make a scholar of me might have, unfortunately, worked. For, while I hope to never return to the Calligrapher's Guild, I did discover something intriguing. The instructors in the guild, especially the self-proclaimed calligro-cartographer Isasic Shulin, have repeatedly told us it is futile to pick apart the phonemes from old glyphs. Nobody tells me what not to do, except for you, though I don't always listen. So, picking apart old glyphs is exactly what I've done, dissecting them like little biology projects. My rebellion yielded very little until I teased out some bits from the ancient glyph for Roshar, which oddly looks a lot like the ancient symbol for the Knight's Radiant. But the phonemes in the glyph don't say Roshar. If you separate out its components, this emerges. Glyph for Stormlight, or Zeradora, but the phonemes say Tavo Dovast, or Tavast's Light, using Tanavast's Alethi name. Unknown glyph, but reads Korodoros, or Koravari's Light, obviously referring to Koravelium Avast, she who brings the dews at dawn. Unknown glyph, but reads Rasodonar, or Rasan's Light, Rasan being an Alethi name for rays. I suspect we'll see this glyph again. Then again, I also dissected the glyph for love and discovered the principal phonemes for friendly Kremling. So I could be, as they say, seeing shades in the mist, unless we're looking for a new name for our little organization. Next page, how to swear like a horn eater. O'o kale la'ae.
73. Which master to follow? 8 years ago. Venli could hear new rhythms. She tried to hide this fact, attuning the old boring rhythms around others. It was so difficult. The new rhythms were her majesty, the proof that she was special. She wanted to shout them, flaunt them. Quiet, Ulim said from her gem heart. Quiet for now, Venli. There will be time enough later to enjoy the rhythm of praise. She attuned exaltation, but did not hum it as she walked through the room where her scholars worked. Ulim had given her hints about finding another form, nimble form. He wouldn't tell her the exact process yet, so she'd gathered these scholars and set them to work. Over time, she intended to use them as an excuse to reveal many important discoveries, including ones that Ulim had promised her, greater forms than these. Power. You are special, Ulim whispered, as she idled near a pair of her scholars who were trying to trap a windspren that had flown in to tease them. I could sense you from far away, Venli. You were chosen by our god, the true god of all singers. He sent me to explain how wonderful you are. The words comforted her. Yes, that was right. She would wear forms of power. Only, hadn't she once wanted those for her mother? Wasn't that the point? You will be great, he said within her gem heart. Everyone will recognize your majesty. Well, I want nimble forms soon, she whispered to Ulim, stepping out of the chamber. It has been too long since war form. My sister and her sycophants get to tromp around the cities on display like heroes. Let them. Those are your grunts, who will be sent to die fighting the humans once our plot is accomplished. You should take time finding nimble form. It will be too suspicious for you to find another so soon. She folded her arms, listening to the new rhythm praise her. The city buzzed with activity, thousands of listeners from a dozen families passing by, Eshonai and the others had made great strides toward true unity, and the elders of the various families were talking to one another. Who would get the glory for that? Venli had orchestrated this grand convergence, but everyone ignored her. Perhaps she should have taken war form. Ulim had urged her to be one of the first, but she'd hesitated. She hadn't been frightened, no, but she'd assumed she could manipulate better without taking the form. That had been a mistake, and this was her reward, Eshonai taking all the credit. Next time, Venli would do it herself. Ulim, she whispered, when will the other Voidspren be ready? Can't say for certain, he replied. That stupid herald is still standing strong all these years later. We have to work around him. The new storm, Venli whispered. Yes, it's been building in Shadesmar for centuries. We need to get our agents close enough to it on this side, a place that is out in the ocean, mind you, so they can use gemstones to pull my brothers and sisters across. Then those stones have to be physically transported here. You have no idea how much of a pain it all is. I'm well acquainted by now, she said to derision. You never shut up about it. Hey, you're the only one I get to talk to. And I like to talk. So, nimble form. When? We have bigger problems. Your people aren't ready to accept forms of power. At all. They're far too timid. And the way they fight. What's wrong with the way we fight? Venli asked, conceit. Our warriors are powerful and intimidating. Please, Ulim replied. The humans have remembered how to make good steel all these centuries, and even figured out some things we never learned. Meanwhile, your people throw spears at each other like primitives. They yell and dance more than they fight. It's embarrassing. Maybe you should have gone to the humans then. Don't be childish, Ulim said. You need to know what you're facing. Imagine 100,000 men in glistening armor moving in coordinated blocks, lifting a wall of interlocking shields broken only by the spears coming out to bite your flesh. Imagine thousands upon thousands of archers, loosing waves of arrows that sweep in a deadly rain. Imagine men on horseback, charging, thunder without lightning, and riding down anyone in their path. You think you can face that with a few semi-coherent boasts? Venli's confidence wavered. She looked out toward the shattered plains, where their war forms trained on a nearby plateau. She'd nudged them toward that, following Ulim's suggestions. He knew a lot about manipulating people. With his help, she could get the others to do pretty much anything. A part of her thought she should be concerned about that. But when she tried to think along those lines, her mind grew fuzzy, and she ended up circling back to whatever she'd been thinking about before. Eshonai guesses that the humans are bluffing about how many cities they have, she said. But if they have dozens like they told us, then our numbers would be roughly equal, if we can get all the families to listen to us.
Roughly equal? Ulim said, then started laughing. An outrageous sound, uproarious.
It made her gem heart vibrate.
You and them? Even? Oh, you blessed little idiot.
Venli felt herself attune agony. She hated the way he made her feel sometimes. He'd whisper about how great she was, but then they'd get deep into a conversation and he'd speak more freely, more derogatorily. Well, she said, maybe we don't have to fight them. Maybe we can find another way.
Kid, you're not gonna have a choice on that one, Ulim said. They will make sure of it. You know what they've done to all the other singers in the world? They're slaves.
Yes, Venli said. Proof that my ancestors were wise in leaving.
Yeah, please don't say that around any of my friends, Ulim said. You'll make me look bad. Your ancestors were traitors, and no matter what you do, the humans will make you fight. Trust me, it's what they always do. Your primitive little paradise here is doomed. Best you can do is train some soldiers, practice using the terrain to your advantage, and prepare to get some actual forms. You don't get to choose to be free, Venli. Just which master to follow. Venli pushed off from the wall and began walking through the city. Something was wrong about Ulim, about her, about the way she thought now.
You have no idea the power that awaits you, Venli, Ulim said to the rhythm of craving. In the old days, forms of power were reserved for the most special, the most valuable. They were strong, capable of amazing feats.
Then how did we ever lose? She asked.
Bah, it was a fluke. We couldn't break the last herald, and the humans found some way to pin the whole oath pact on him. So we got stuck on Braze. Eventually, the Unmade decided to start a war without us. That turned out to be exceedingly stupid. In the past, Odium granted forms of power, but Ba-Edo Mishram thought she could do it. Ended up handing out forms of power as easily as fused give each other titles. Connected herself to the entire Singer species. Became a little god. Too little.
Don't understand.
I'll bet you don't. Basically, everyone relied way too much on an oversized Spren. Trouble is, Spren can get stuck in gemstones, and the humans figured this out. End result, Ba-Edo Mishram got a really cramped prison, and everyone's souls got seriously messed up. It will take something big to restore the minds of the Singers around the world. So we're going to prime the pump, so to speak, with your people. Get them into storm form and pull the big storm over from Shadesmar. Odium thinks it will work, and considering he's anything but a little god, we are going to do what he says. It's better than the alternative, which generally involves a lot of pain and the occasional flavorful dismemberment.
Venli nodded to some listeners passing by. Members of another family. She could tell by the colors of the bands on their braids and the type of gemstone bits in the men's beards. Venli deliberately hummed one of the week-old rhythms for them to hear, but these newcomers didn't give her a second glance, despite her importance.
Patience, Ulim said. Once the return arrives, you will be proclaimed as the one who initiated it. And you will be given everything you deserve as the most important of all listeners.
You say my ancestors were traitors, Venli whispered. But you need us. If they hadn't split off, you wouldn't have us to use in your plot. You should bless what they did.
They got lucky. Doesn't mean they weren't traitors.
Perhaps they knew what Ba-Edo Mishram was going to do, and so they attuned wisdom, not betrayal, in their actions. She knew the name, of course. As a keeper of songs, she knew the names of all 9 Unmade, who were among the gods her people swore to never follow again. But the more she talked with Ulim, the less regard she gave the songs. The old listeners had memorized the wrong things. How could they retain the names of the Unmade, but forget something as simple as how to adopt work form?
Anyway, who cares what your ancestors did, Ulim said. We need to prepare your people for forms of power, then get them to summon Odium's storm. Everything will take care of itself after that.
That might be harder than you think, Spren, Venli said to derision. She quieted her voice as another group of listeners passed. The city was so packed these days, you could barely find any peace to think.
Forms of power, Venli. The ability to reshape the world. Strength beyond anything you've ever dreamed of having.
She stuffed her hands into the pockets of her robe as she reached the heart of the city. She hadn't realized she was coming this way, to her family's home. She stepped inside and found her mother picking apart a rug she had woven. Jack Slim glanced up at Venli, jumping.
"It's only me," Venli said to Peace. "I got it wrong again," Jack Slim said, huddling over her rug. "Wrong every time."
Venli tried to attune indifference, one of the new rhythms, but she couldn't find it. Not here, not with her mother. She instead settled down on the floor, cross-legged, like she'd sat as a child when learning the songs.
"Mother?" Venli asked to praise. "Everyone makes mistakes. Why can't I do anything right anymore? Mother, can you tell me the first song?" Venli whispered.
Jack Slim kept picking at the rug.
"You know it," Venli said. "Days we sing, days we once knew, days of pain," Jack Slim said, to the rhythm of memories. "Days of loss, days of glory."
Venli nodded as Jack Slim continued. This song was more of a chant, the original recitation of her people leaving the war, leaving their gods, striking out on their own.
"This is painful to hear," Ulim noted. "Your people had no idea what they were doing."
Venli ignored him, listening, feeling the rhythm of memories, feeling like herself. This had all been about finding a way to help her mother, hadn't it? At the start?
"No," she admitted. "That's what you told yourself. But you wanted more. You've always wanted more."
She knew forms changed the way a person thought. But was she in a new form now? Ulim had been dodgy in explaining it. Evidently, she had a normal spren in her gem heart to give her work form. But Ulim was there too, crowding in, and he could speak to her, even hear what she was thinking.
"You single-handedly delivered war form to your people," Ulim whispered. "Once you give them additional forms, they will revere you, worship you."
She wanted that respect. She wanted it so badly, but she forced herself to listen to what her ancestors had done, 400 of them striking out alone, wearing dull form.
"The fools were inbred then," Ulim said. "No wonder."
"These people created us," she whispered.
Her mother continued singing and didn't seem to have heard the interruption.
"They were not fools. They were heroes. Their primary teaching preserved in everything we do is to never let our gods rule us again, to never take up forms of power, to never serve Odium."
"Then don't serve him," Ulim said. "Deal with him. You have something he needs. You can approach him from a place of power. Your ancestors were lowly things. That was why they wanted to leave. If they'd been at the top like your people will be, they'd have never wanted such a thing."
Venli nodded, but she was more persuaded by other arguments. War was coming with the humans. She could feel it in the way their soldiers eyed her people's weapons. They had enslaved those Parshmen. They'd do the same to Venli's people. The ancient songs had become irrelevant the moment Eshonai had led the humans to the shattered plains. The listeners could no longer hide. Conflict would find them. It was no longer a choice between their gods or freedom. It was a choice between their gods and human slaving brands.
"How do we proceed?" Ulim asked.
Venli closed her eyes, listening to her mother's words. Her ancestors had been desperate.
"We will need to be equally desperate," Venli whispered. My people need to see what I have seen, that we can no longer remain as we have been. The humans will destroy them. Yes, help me prove it. I am your servant in this, Ulim said to subservience. What do you propose? Venli listened. Jack Slim's voice cracked, and she trailed off. Jack Slim had forgotten the song again. The older female and turned away and cried softly. It broke Venli's heart. You have agents among the humans, Ulim? Venli whispered. We do. Can you communicate with them? I have ways of doing so. Have your agents influence those at the palace, Venli said. Get the Alethi to invite us to visit. Their king spoke of it before he left. He's considering it already. We must bring our people there, then show them how powerful the humans are. We must overwhelm my people with our own insignificance. She stood up, then went to comfort her mother. We must make them afraid, Ulim, Venli thought. We must make them sing to the terrors long into the night. Only then will they listen to our promises. It shall be done, he replied. 74. A symbol.
Words. I used to be good with words. I used to be good at a lot of things.
Venli tried to attune the rhythm of conceit as she walked the halls of Urethiru. She kept finding the rhythm of anxiety instead. It was difficult to attune an emotion she didn't feel. Doing so felt like a worse kind of lie than she normally told. Not a lie to others, or to herself. A lie to Roshar. Timber pulsed comfortingly. These were dangerous times, requiring dangerous choices. That sounds an awful lot like the things Ulim told me, Venli whispered. Timber pulsed again. The little Spren was of the opinion that Venli couldn't be blamed for what she'd done, that the Void Spren had manipulated her mind, her emotions, her goals. Timber, for all her wisdom, was wrong in this. Ulim had heightened Venli's ambitions, her arrogance, but she'd given him the tools to work with. A part of her continued to feel some of those things. Worse, Ulim had occasionally left her gem heart during those days, and she'd still gone through with those plans, without his influence. She might not bear full blame for what had happened, but she'd been a willing part of it. Now she had to do her best to make up for it. So she kept her head high, walking as if she owned the tower, trailed by Relaine, who carried the large crate, as if on her orders. Everyone needed to see her treating him as a servant. Hopefully that would quash some of the rumors about the two of them. He hurried closer as they entered a less populated section of the tower. The tower does feel darker now, Venli, he said to the rhythm of anxiety, which didn't help her own mood. Ever since— Hush, she said. She knew what he'd been about to say. Ever since the fight in the market. The whole tower knew by now that Kaladin Stormblessed, Windrunner and Champion, fought, that his powers still functioned, the Fused had worked hard to spread a different narrative, that he'd been faking radiant powers with Fabrials, that he'd been killed during a cruel attack on innocent Singer civilians in the market. Venli found that story far-fetched, and she knew Stormblessed only by reputation. She doubted the propaganda would fool many humans. If Raboniel had been behind it, the message would have been more subtle. Unfortunately, the Lady of Wishes spent most of her time with her research, and instead let the pursuer lead. His personal troops dominated the tower. Already there had been a half dozen instances of singers beating humans near to death. This place was a simmering cauldron, waiting for the added bit of fuel that would bring it to a boil. Venli needed to be ready to get her people out when that happened. Hopefully the crate Relaine carried would help with that. Head high, hum to conceit, walk slowly but deliberately.
By the time they reached the Radiant Infirmary, Venli's nerves were so tight she could have played a rhythm on them. She shut the door after Relaine. They'd recently had it installed by some human workers, and finally attuned Joy. Inside the infirmary, the human surgeon and his wife cared for the comatose Radiant. They did a far better job of it than Venli's staff. The surgeon knew how to minimize the formation of sores on the humans' bodies and how to spot signs of dehydration. When Venli and Relaine entered, the surgeon's wife, Hasina, hurried over. "Is this them?" she asked Relaine, helping him with the crate.
"Nah, it's my laundry," he said to amusement. "Figured Venli here is so mighty and important, she might be able to get someone to wash it for me."
Joking? Now? How could he act so indifferent? If they were discovered, it would mean their executions. Or worse. The human woman laughed. They carried the box to the back of the room, away from the door. Hasina's son put down the shoestrings he'd been playing with and toddled over. Relaine ruffled his hair, then opened the crate. He moved the decoy papers on top, revealing a group of map cases. Hasina breathed out in a human approximation of the rhythm of awe.
"After Cal and I parted," Relaine explained, "and the queens surrendered, I realized I could go anywhere in the tower. A little black ash mixed with water covered my tattoo, blending it into my pattern. Humans were confined to quarters, and so long as I looked like I was doing something important, the singers ignored me. So I thought to myself, what can I do to best undermine the occupation? I figured I had a day at most before the singers got organized and people started asking who I was. I thought about sabotaging the wells, but realized that would hurt too many innocents. I settled on this." He waved his hand over the round tubes filling the crate. Hasina took one out and unrolled the map inside. It depicted the 37th floor of the tower, meticulously mapped.
"So far as I know," Relaine said, "guard posts and master-servant quarters just contain maps of the lower floors. The upper-level maps were kept in two places, the Queen's Information Vault and the map room. I stopped by the map room and found it burned out, likely at the Queen's order. The vault was on the ground floor, far from where her troops could have reached. I figured it might still be intact."
Relaine shrugged a human shrug.
"It was shockingly easy to get in," he continued to resolve. "The human guards had been killed or removed, but the singers didn't know the value of the place yet. I walked right through a checkpoint, stuffed everything I could into a sack, and wandered out. I said I was on a search detail sent to collect any form of human writing."
"It was brave,"
Lirin the surgeon said, stepping over and folding his arms.
"But I don't know how useful it will be, Relaine. There's not much they'd want on the upper floors."
"It might help Kaladin stay hidden," Relaine said.
"Maybe," Lirin said. "I worry you put yourself through an awful lot of effort and danger to accomplish what might add up to a mild inconvenience for the occupation."
The man was a pragmatist, which Venli appreciated. She, however, was interested in other matters.
"The tunnel complex," she said.
"Is there a map here of the tunnels under the tower?" Relaine dug for a moment, then pulled out a map.
"Here," he said. "Why?"
Venli took it reverently. "It's one of the few paths of escape, Relaine. I came in through these tunnels. They're a complicated maze. Raboniel knew her way through, but I doubt I could get us out on my own. But with this..."
"Didn't the enemy collapse those tunnels?" Lirin asked.
"Yes," Venli said. "But I might have a way around that."
"Even if you do," Lirin said, "we'd have to travel through the most heavily guarded section of the tower, where the Fused are doing their research on the tower fabrials."
"Yes, But could she use her powers to form a tunnel through the stone? One that bypassed Raboniel's workstation and the shield, then intersected with these caverns below? Perhaps. Though there was still the greater problem. Before they could run, she had to ensure the fused wouldn't give chase. Escaping the tower only to die by a heavenly one's hand in the mountains would accomplish nothing. Relaine, Hasina said, these are wonderful. You did more than anyone could have expected of you.
I might have been able to do more if I hadn't messed up, Relaine said to Reconciliation. I was stopped in the hallway, asked to give the name of the fused I was operating under. I should have played dumb instead of using the name of one I'd heard earlier in the day. Turns out that fused doesn't keep a staff. She's one of the lost ones. You could have locked yourself in a cell the moment the tower fell, Lyran said, and pretended to be a prisoner. That way the fused could have liberated you, and no one would be suspicious. Every human in the tower knows about me, Lyran, Relaine said. The tame Parshendi your son keeps. If I'd tried a ploy like that, the singers would have found me eventually and I'd have ended up in a cell for real.